Hey all, welcome to the first episode of Whiskey and IR Theory. In this podcast, Daniel Nexon, that's me, and Patrick Thaddeus Jackson, or PTJ, drink some booze and work our way through a book or article with significant international relations theory content. Our current plan is to focus on classics and older work, but if we can keep this going, then that may change. Who knows? This is the first of two episodes in which we discuss Kenneth Waltz's classic Theory of International Politics, which was first published in 1979. For better, or some would say for worse, it remains one of the most important quote-unquote canonical works of the 20th century, particularly in the realist tradition. Theory of International Politics, or TIP as it's often abbreviated, is Waltz's third book. We talk a bit about Waltz's biography in the podcast, but I thought it would be useful to briefly describe his major works. Waltz's first book, Man, the State, and War, was based on his dissertation. It came out in 1959. In it, Waltz looks at various arguments about the causes of war. He divides these arguments into three types, or what he terms images. First image explanations claim that human nature or human psychology drives war. Waltz argues that these provide inadequate explanations. Even if certain psychological dispositions made leaders more likely to fight wars, there isn't much we could do about it, because we can't do things like institute a litmus test for potential leaders and heads of state. Second image counts explain war with reference to the domestic characteristics of states. These include Marxist-Leninist theories that attribute warfare to capitalism, or liberal arguments that if we didn't have autocratic states, we wouldn't fight wars. Waltz also considers second image explanations flawed. Third image accounts locate the causes of war in the makeup of the international system. Waltz likes these. He argues that the international system is anarchical. It lacks a common authority to make and enforce rules. It is akin to the state of nature in social contract theory. And indeed, social contract theorists such as Locke and Hobbes argue that relations between states do have similar qualities to the state of nature. Since international politics lacks an authority to adjudicate disputes, there is nothing, per se, to stop two states from going to war. Since war is an omnipresent possibility, states prepare for it and turn to it when the stakes are high enough. Waltz's second book was published in 1967. Very few people read it. I have, but I don't remember it very well. So here's how Robert Art and Robert Jervis describe it in Foreign Affairs. Quote, "Foreign Policy and Democratic Politics argued that contrary to what was believed on both sides of the Atlantic when he published it in 1967, the American political system was better designed to produce effective foreign policy than the British one." Which takes us up to Theory of International Politics. Here's the too long didn't read. TIP is squarely in the tradition of Waltz's first book. The international system is anarchical. No actor enjoys authority to command obedience from other actors. Anarchical orders are governed by principles of self-help. As Waltz argues, quote, "units in the condition of anarchy, be they people, corporations, states, or whatever, must rely on the means they can make for themselves. Since self-help requires states to prioritize their security over, say, domestic welfare, states are primed to pay attention to changes in relative capabilities. Survival depends on preventing any state or coalition of states from developing the ability to subordinate all others. That is, it depends on being able to balance against would-be hegemons. Actors may seek to balance by expanding their own capabilities, which Waltz terms internal balancing, or by forming countervailing coalitions, what he terms external balancing. Processes of competition and socialization tend to bring all states into conformity with these expectations, or at least it brings the great powers into conformity with these expectations. Those that fail to pay attention to relative power, quote, fall by the wayside, end quote. The net result, international politics are driven by the balance of power mechanism and characterized by recurrent balancing equilibria. Anarchy and self-help also mean that international systems tend toward functional undifferentiation. Since all states have to protect themselves and have to focus on their security, there is no international division of labor. Thus, the distribution of power is the only structural variable that distinguishes between different international systems. Waltz's theory describes the international system qua system. It does not offer a self-contained account of micro-level behavior, what Waltz terms foreign policy. This will become important later on in our discussion. For Waltz, Therefore, the texture of international politics is generally stable, altering, quote, so long as none of the competing units is able to convert the anarchic international realm into a hierarchic realm, end quote. Structural realists discount the significance of bandwagoning, that is, siding with a stronger side as a form of alliance politics, because if it predominated in a system, quote, we would see a world hegemony forged, end quote. Before we transition to discussion, I have a few notes. First, Patrick and I don't have a budget and we're doing this for fun. This means there are issues with the audio quality and other kinks that will hopefully work out over time. Second, I pretty much stole the idea for this from one of my favorite podcasts, Game Studies Study Buddies, which is far superior and which you should subscribe to. Third, the music in this podcast was arranged and performed by Lyra Gemmel Nexon. Yes, that's my daughter. The opening and closing track is Philip Rossiter's Galliard. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this. Part 2 should be out within a few weeks, and we plan to record a new episode once a month, or something like that. We'll see. All right, so today we are reading Theory of International Politics by Kenneth Waltz. And what whiskey are we pairing with that, Patrick?
Well, I thought, because Waltz is such a ubiquitous theoretical name in IR circles, that we should choose a whiskey that you are almost guaranteed to find in almost any bar you would walk into, but we also don't want to drink, you know, Glenfiddich or something. So I have gone with a relatively standard Laphroaig 10, which also has a nice medicinal note to it, which I think reflects some of many of our colleagues, and perhaps even our first experiences reading Waltz in graduate school, that it was a tough piece of medicine that one had to swallow. And it's also a very complex whiskey, and I think it's a pretty complex book.
All right, well, cheers.
Cheers.
So this book was published in 1979, which makes it 41 years old. And if you think about the fact that that Waltz was working on this for a while and there were various chapters and things in circulation, it's been around for a really long time. So why are we reading it? Why did we decide this was going to be our first book?
Well, I'm not going to speak for you, but the reason I thought that having Waltz as our first book, a couple different agendas that it serves or different points that it makes. First, Waltz is kind of ubiquitous, as I said before, which is you kind of can't do international relations theory in the English-speaking world without running into Waltz at some point.
Although I think there are plenty of people who would prefer that you could avoid him entirely and are doing their best to do so.
I would agree that lots of people would argue that you can, but I think most people educated in international relations in Britain or the United States in the last 30 or 40 years have had to go through the experience of reading and grappling with Waltz at least some point. And certainly when one is doing the typical realism, liberalism, constructivism kind of framing of research articles, Waltz is generally one of the first realist citations or neo-realist citations that shows up. So there's a way that this book is so widely disseminated in the bloodstream, if you will, of international relations theorizing, that it seems like a pretty good place to start. Also, we've written some stuff on Waltz and a kind of non-standard reading of Waltz. And every once in a while, I know I certainly have the experience of being asked to review things in which people are doing readings of Waltz. So I think against what either of us ever set out to do, we've become Waltz experts, in that because we've written on this and we've written on ways of reading what it is that Waltz is up to, that we sort of get associated with those.
Yeah, I have this kind of pet theory that Waltz is to international relations like Talcott Parsons is to sociology, that it's very difficult to understand what happens in the field in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s on the theory side without understanding that a lot of it is engaged with theory of international politics, now often negatively, right? I mean,
yes. The
number of people who are actually Waltzians is far outweighed by the number of people who like to use it as a straw man or a other as they build their work.
But I still think that it's kind of, I agree with you, I think it's sort of inescapable. We should probably say a few words about who Ken Waltz was, because he died a few years ago.
Yes. So Waltz, I'm going to consult the ever-present source of knowledge, the Wikipedia entry.
Just for notes, students, you can do this at home, but don't cite Wikipedia in your papers, because for some reason that drives professors crazy.
Yeah, maybe that's the subject of a future podcast. But Waltz was born in 1924. He was a veteran of both World War II and the Korean War. He got his PhD in 1954 from Columbia. Hey, we know that place. And he got his PhD under the supervision of William T.R. Fox, who is one of the older sort of classic international relations theorists and scholars in the American context.
And by classic international relations scholars and theorists in this context, we mean somebody nobody really reads anymore.
Correct. And people will occasionally refer to their name or maybe the one thing they're known for. Bill Fox, his main legacy, actually, is that he invented the word superpower.
Ooh.
And the word superpower entered the international relations lexicon because of this book that Fox wrote in, I think, 1946. But I also want to draw that link between Waltz and Fox by way of saying that Ken Waltz was a grand old man of the grand old international relations subfield of U.S. political science. This was a small, tightly knit group of almost exclusively guys, all white, that were very tightly interconnected with one another, even though their careers moved in different institutions. There are sort of nodal points that they all pass through in various ways. Waltz is one of those. Waltz is the second generation of that, right? If Bill Fox is part of the first generation of that, then Waltz is kind of one of the leading figures in the second generation of that. So this is not an anti-establishment guy, despite the fact that his critiques of other international relations scholars would lead you to believe that he is someone who's sort of on the outside of what the mainstream is doing.
Other also important to note that Waltz started out life wanting to be a political theorist, mm-hmm. And then moved into international relations. And I think that shows up in a lot of ways, certainly in Man, the State, and War, which climaxes with Rousseau, and then in Theory of International Politics, where he's sort of drawing on a number of classical political theorists to make arguments.
Absolutely. Waltz is also in that way kind of emblematic of a time in the discipline where it was possible to be a political theorist and an empirical researcher in ways that have become a little more subspecialized now, right? Waltz is able to kind of move mm-hmm. between these things.
So anyway, he gets his PhD at Columbia.
PhD at Columbia in 1954. He taught at Swarthmore for a few years. He then went to Berkeley. He taught at Berkeley for 25 odd years, retires in 1997, came back to Columbia, finished his career there as an adjunct instructor, overlapped with us a little bit.
Yeah, I actually was a pretty advanced IR grad student, which, if you know me, is another way of saying it took me a really long time to finish. And so I actually took his course when he came. So I got to go through a course that, as best I can tell, was structured around things I read that culminated in Theory of International Politics.
Which, if you're Ken Waltz, you get to teach that class at the end of your career, and everybody wants to take it, which is fascinating. He was the president of the American Political Science Association from 66 to 67, or sorry, 87 to 88. He was the secretary in 66 to 67. And as far as I know, was never president of the International Studies Association, at least it's not listed there. But he is, I believe, he's not the most well-cited scholar in international relations. He was for a while. I think he's like second or third now in terms of aggregate citations.
You know, let's check.
We should
this.
Check that. We should use the magical internet devices that we have in front of us and see.
So did you find what you were looking for?
I found a couple of things that are at least indicative of the lasting influence, lasting power of Waltz's scholarship. So when the Teaching Research International Policy survey that was run out of William & Mary asked I believe this is the 2012 report, four scholars that have produced the best work in the field of IR in the past 20 years, Waltz was ranked number 9. Mm. Four scholars who've had the greatest influence.
What year was this?
This I believe this is the 2012 report.
Okay, so...
Yes, so this is the May 2012 report, so it's a little bit out of date, but...
So people really like that essay on the end of the Cold War that he wrote in the 90s or the early 2000s, presidential address.
Exactly. Right. That was totally what they were going for.
Okay.
And then four scholars who had the greatest influence in the field of IR in the past 20 years. Number three, coming directly behind Alexander Wendt and Robert Cohane, is Ken Waltz. And the other thing that I thought was interesting was an article by Desch and Avey back in 2014 talking about the top scholars in international relations ranked by fellow academics and secondly by policymakers. There are only three names that occur on both lists. Those names are Joseph Nye, Robert Jervis, and Kenneth N. Walt. So.
Okay. Well, let's get started. So, Theory of International Politics is about 200 pages in the edition that I have, runs 9 chapters. It is, I will say, sometimes it's a good read, sometimes it's pretty hard going. There's a lot of repetition, and I kind of wonder sometimes whether that repetitiveness is a consequence of having written in an era before modern word processors, or whether it's just something about the way that this book is constructed specifically. So I think, though, that chapter one is about kind of Waltz's view of what theories are and the way they relate to general, what we call nomothetical laws, that is, general, how they relate to correlational relationships between variables. And I think that, Patrick, you should start us out on this because this is really your bailiwick.
Bailiwick. I'm happy to do so. But before I do that, let me take 30 seconds and take a page from an old professor of ours, Ira Katznelson, who always suggested you have to read the preface and the acknowledgments. And I will say that this time when I looked at the preface and the acknowledgments, the thing that struck me most forcefully is that there is exactly one woman mentioned in the acknowledgments, and she is mentioned for expertly coping with an unrelenting flow of tapes. Apparently, Waltz showed the book to a number of other scholars, but I just found it very interesting that it was the only female name mentioned is the secretary. So yes, this is definitely an artifact of it being before word processors, because there's someone else who typed it.
I actually know whether Nadine Zelensky was a secretary, because I know that at Columbia, when I was a grad student, Bob Jervis had people who took transcription. He had an old transcription machine. I don't know if he still does. And that was always staffed by graduate students.
Ah, so she may have been a graduate student.
I'm sure somebody who's listening will know this and be like, those guys have no idea what they're talking about.
Okay. Well, Nadine Zelensky is her name. Not a name that I am familiar with, unfortunately. But after the preface and the acknowledgments, which lays out a little bit of the context of what it is that Waltz is trying to do, and the endless road to theory, as he puts it. So, laws and theory. So the main burden of the first chapter is to distinguish between empirical generalizations on the one hand and theories on the other. Waltz, in fairly typical kind of neo-positivist fashion, argues that the purpose of theory is to explain these invariant generalizations, but the generalizations themselves are not theory. Those he calls laws, which is fascinating. The law is a persistent association of variables across different cases, across space and time. But theories, Waltz says, explain laws.
Yeah, right there in chapter 5. Rather than being mere collections of laws, theories are statements that explain them.
Yep. So, and then further a little bit further down in that same paragraph, theories show why these associations obtain. So one of the constant refrains that shows up again and again in the book is that existing international relations scholarship at the time Waltz is writing were largely composed, in Waltz's view, of collections of laws and various things that were derived from a lot of historical experience, but not a set of theoretical explanations for them. So a theory for Waltz has to explain, and how does it do this? It does this through abstraction. One of the other main themes of the chapter is a good theory is a theory that steps back from descriptive accuracy and ends up with a set of spare theoretical terms that allow the explanation of why we see the sorts of generalizations that we see. So on the bottom of page 8, the line that's often quoted, a theory is a picture mentally formed of a bounded realm or domain of activity, but it's not an edifice of truth and not a reproduction of reality. And he says, a little bit further down that paragraph, the infinite materials of any realm can be organized in endlessly different ways. The theory indicates that some factors are more important than others and specifies relations among them. Now, there's a really interesting ambiguity in that word indicates, because at some times, Waltz appears to say that what a theory does is it points you to the things that are actually important in a particular realm. But at other times in the book, both in this chapter and elsewhere, he kind of flips that around and says, actually, the theory leads you to regard certain things as important rather than simply reflecting what is actually important. And Waltz dances around both sides of that throughout the rest of the chapter. There's a rather striking formulation of this on page 10, where he says, even by those who have authored them, the emergence of theories cannot be described in other than uncertain and impressionistic ways. So there's no definitive way to produce a theory. It has more to do with sort of marinating in sets of empirical relations and then coming up with some logically spare way of trying to abstract from them and characterize them.
So basically, by the end of the first section of the first chapter, Waltz has told us that theories are not laws, theories are not real, theories are simplifications, and he even adopts a kind of somewhat relativistic position on the content of the theory itself, mm-hmm. right? If you remember, he invokes Kuhn.
Yep.
He says, you know, it's hard to sort of adjudicate whether or not we, you know, see things because of the theory, or I mean, am I wrong here? Yeah.
No, there's, yeah. There's on the top of 12, the direct quotation from Kuhn, right? We cannot say that they possess the same data, but identify or interpret it differently. We cannot say with any assurance that the two men see even the same thing if they have different theories.
Changes of theory produce changes in the meaning of terms, both theoretical and factual ones.
But at the same time, he also says, a little further down 12, the theory conveys a sense of how things work, how they hang together, and what the structure of a realm of inquiry may be. And on the top of the next page, an approach that is appropriate to the subject matter. So it's almost like he wants to have it both ways. The theory abstracts and produces a world, but at the same time, that produced world can be more or less appropriate. And I'm not entirely sure how we evaluate the appropriateness of that. And I think this is an ambiguity that's going to run throughout.
Yeah, it's going to really, it's going to come back to haunt us and haunt the book.
Yes.
So he has these criteria in section 2 about testing a theory.
Mm-hmm.
What did you make of those? I mean, he says, okay, I mean, here's what the criteria are. We shouldn't spend 30 minutes on this chapter just because it's something that, you know, Patrick has deep knowledge of the debates about. But, you know, he says that we need to state the theory being tested. That's the first thing. The second thing is infer hypotheses from it. This is on page 13.
Mm-hmm.
The third is subject the hypotheses to experimental or observational tests. The fourth is in taking steps 2 and 3, use the definition of terms found in the theory being tested. The fifth step is eliminate or control perturbing variables not included in the theory under test. The sixth is devise a number of distinct and demanding tests. The seventh and last is, if a test is not passed, ask whether the theory flunks completely, needs repair and restatement, or requires a narrowing of the scope of explanatory claims. This is going to turn out to be mostly, I think, a cudgel he uses to attack other people.
Yes, and there is a way that this is a kind of laundry list that makes more descriptive sense, I think, than it does prescriptive sense. Mm-hmm. He's nicely summarized a whole lot of different things that different people across the social and natural sciences do.
Mm-hmm.
But figuring out the relative importance of these things, which is, of course, what all the debates in the philosophy of science are about, which of these kinds of steps are more important than others. Waltz doesn't want to get into those discussions. And so, as I think you're right, a lot of this is about distancing what he's doing from other people.
Yeah, I mean, he spends the next two pages basically kind of obnoxiously, to be honest, attacking quantitative scholars. Right, he doesn't think they measure anything right. I mean, to give a sense of the way that Waltz deals with people he doesn't agree with, after going through all of the flaws in this piece by Singer, Bremer, and Stuckey — Singer is one of the really important people in the development of behavioral and quantitative approaches to international relations — he says, rules 1, 2, and 4 are thus blithely ignored. the theories being tested are not stated, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. In the face of such failures, one finds it hard to believe that here, as so often in the correlational labors undertaken by students of international politics, no thought is, is given to the possible presence of perturbing variables. Mm-hmm. He really hates statistical work.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I, it's interesting, too, is one of the things about going back and rereading this, which is a book that we both read in graduate school, is I have marginal notes in here from different times that I've read it. And I can guess because I look at my handwriting and the colors of the pen and kind of figure out what's going on where. And it's interesting to see the consistency of some of the mixed feelings I always had about this book. The idea that theory was something other than aggregated empirical generalizations was always a notion that I thought, yes, this is right. I agree with this. But then the idea that you could somehow take those logical theoretical notions and subject them to empiricist testing always struck me as a bit strange. So, you know, you all can't see this, but you know, you can see my notes here. Yay. And then no.
Okay. I don't want to, we've spent a bunch of time in this chapter already. We got 8 more chapters to go, but kind of, what do you think of these arguments, right? Obviously you just said you like the idea that a theory is not simply the law-like generalization, but you disagree with a whole bunch of it. So, I mean, you're somebody who has studied epistemology theory. You have a book on philosophy of social sciences, international relations. Kind of, what do you think?
Well, ultimately what I think here is that what Waltz is doing, but not really acknowledging, is he's taking a set of commonsensical understandings among international relations scholars. He's logically cleaning them up and purifying them. And then, having done that, he's then bringing in certain kinds of scientific hypothesis testing gestures as ways of trying to flesh this out. It's not a methodology-driven book in that sense. The methodology is definitely secondary to the theory that he wants to propound. And the theory that he wants to propound, as he says a couple of times during the text, is commonsensical among a certain group of international relations scholars. And I think that if we read it in that light, then a lot of the work that he does here about simplifying and logically pure assumptions sound very much like a kind of classical Weberian sociological way of thinking about these as ideal types. But because Waltz is also working in an environment where hypothesis testing is the order of the day for any kind of scientific theory, he feels like he needs to use
one. Right. So chapter 2 is on reductionist theories, and it continues this theme of everybody else is doing it wrong, which is really like a lot of this book. Mm-hmm. This chapter opens with, among the depressing features of international political studies is the small gain in explanatory power that has come from the large amount of work done in recent decades. Nothing seems to accumulate, not even criticism. So basically what he does in this chapter is he explains what a reductionist theory is in his view, and then he goes and uses the example of sort of Hobson's and Lenin's theories of imperialism to show us that reductionist theories are wrong by basically bashing this. After saying this is the best reductionist theory out there, he bashes it around for a bit. There's sort of kind of one major analytic point, which is that, so Waltz says a reductionist theory is any theory that tries to explain the whole, the system level, solely from the perspective of the parts, right? And just if you don't know Waltz or don't know the general arguments, reductionist theories are bad. They're really, really bad. They're so bad that oftentimes it'll feel like he's begging the question. The other important thing to note here is that his definition of reductionist theories is, if you go and Google the definition of reductionism, that's what you'll get, right? That it's explaining the whole with reference to smaller parts, or trying to reduce complex macro-level phenomena to micro-level phenomena. Mm-hmm. But if you actually look at sort of more philosophy of social science, that's one version of reductionism. Mm-hmm. Reductionism is sort of more broadly understood as any time that we take one domain or one theory and we reduce it to another domain or another theory. And this is sort of important because I was reading this and kind of thinking, Stacey Goddard and I have a article about Waltz and Waltz's theories, and I'm not going to run you through it right now. I mean, some of the arguments we make there will come up as we talk. But one of the things we stress is that one way to understand Waltz is that he ultimately also doesn't like reduction to the system level. But here he doesn't define it in any way that that makes that argument possible. You have to import that argument.
And part of there's an equivocation in Waltz that's interesting here, because on the one hand, reductionism in his language is about using state-level attributes or state-level variables to explain broader
Or the interactions,
anything that happens below the level of the structure of the system as a whole. But he also kind of slips sometimes. At the top of page 26, particular acts have particular causes which account for some part of the outcomes that interests us. In dealing with particular causes, however, we're dealing with matters that are more interesting historically than theoretically. So there's a way in which he slips between the notion of reduction as being about level of abstraction, explaining in terms of a lower level, and reduction as being about monocausal explanations. And he goes back and forth between those two, and sometimes the things that are considered reductionist are reductionist because they're ignoring the structure of the system. Sometimes they're reductionist because they're monocausal.
I thought that sort of one of the other things that you would like about it is that oftentimes when he's describing specific historical outcomes, he's really taking a Weberian singular causal analysis approach. He basically doesn't think we can develop any generalizations about specific outcomes. He uses language like why, you know, the United States did X on Tuesday, or why this particular war broke out when it did. Right. And so very much the realm of unit levels is a realm for him that's full of contingency.
Yes.
While the realm of systems and system structure is what causes patterns, right? It makes sort of predictability and makes some general kind of proclivities possible.
Right.
But the other thing he does in this chapter, as I mentioned, is he goes after Hobson and Lenin, and then Hobson, then a synthesis, and then various attempts to extend the theory. There were some things in here. So this is the part that I always skipped. I mean, there was nothing underlined in this section. I thought there were some interesting things in here. Did anything speak to you? Did, like, anything?
Yeah, I mean, what fascinates me is how seriously he took Hobson and Lenin as theories of international relations. Even though now, outside of very restricted Marxist circles, I don't think you really get, like, Hobsonian theory as being, like, a going concern.
Well,
Hobson's like a drive-by citation now.
Right, well, I mean,
not John Hobson, yeah. Like, not the current one, but this guy, who's his grandfather? Great-grandfather?
I don't know.
There's some relation.
The Soviet Union collapses and Marxist inflected theories kind of, we don't have to take them with the same seriousness, I guess, in international relations. I mean, Hobson's theory of imperialism, I read this. I couldn't really summarize it very well, even having read this, but essentially it's that capitalist economies, they've surplus capital, and they can't use that surplus capital domestically, so they look abroad to use that surplus capital, and then when they're going abroad and investing abroad or trading abroad, they demand that, those capitalists wind up demanding that their home state come in and protect them, come in and make sure they can do their trading right. And so that's how you get imperialism, right, more or less?
Yeah.
And so you can think about kind of what somebody who's writing that theory has in mind. They're thinking about, and Waltz talks about this specifically, Gallagher and Robinson's examples of how the flag follows trade in Africa, that a lot of the sort of, when the imperial authorities step in, it's kind of to make things safe for their merchants. Or he's thinking about extraterritoriality and unequal treaties that the Europeans are making with China, right? This is kind of all fits this model. And, his basic argument here, I think he's right. I mean, his basic argument here is capitalism can't explain imperialism because imperialism exists long before capitalism. And capitalism can't explain imperialism because non-capitalist states engage in imperialism.
Right.
But essentially, and this is very similar, if you know Man, the State, and War, this is very similar to the arguments he makes about why second image explanations, that is, explanations about regime type, are not good explanations for war. There, I think he uses an example of how the socialists in Germany, despite being committed to socialist internationalism, the moment, like, you're mobilizing to war, they become hardened nationalists, sticking up for German interests. So he basically says that these theories, they can't account for any variation. Imperialism's a constant. Ultimately, he says, ultimately he's going to say imperialism happens because great powers can do what they want, and sometimes what they want involves conquering or dominating other states.
Right.
And then he actually has an interesting discussion of neocolonialism. You know, he essentially says neocolonial theory is a degenerative attempt to salvage Marxist theories of imperialism by redefining other things as imperialism.
Right.
And he's pretty salty about it. You know, he's pretty dismissive. You can see him really building this theme that there's a lot of stuff that just runs throughout history. It sort of happens regardless of the economic system you're in, the types of actors you have, whether you have city-states or empires or national states. And because of that, it just doesn't, in his view, make sense to try to explain those things with reference to the properties of units.
Right.
There is another option, right? Which is that in a world of multi-causality, you could have features of those units producing similar outcomes right. independent of overarching structures, but whatever, let's take that off the table.
Yeah, I mean, it almost seems to be an article of faith with him on top of 37 at the end of that chapter. Internationally, different states have produced similar as well as different outcomes, and similar states produce different as well as similar outcomes. The same causes lead to different effects. The same effects sometimes follow from different causes. And then there's the leap. We are led to suspect that reductionist explanations of international politics are insufficient and that analytic approaches must give way to systemic ones.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting parallel structure, because then reductionist explanations and analytic approaches become equivalent. If analytic and reduction become similar, then systemic almost can't be reductionist by definition. So
that's what I meant when I said a lot of this, you know, it just feels like he's begging the question a lot of the time. Like, you know, he's making arguments with the presumption that we already agree with him.
And I think for the audience that he's writing to, I think there's something very interesting here. If we read this as a particular piece of rhetoric, he's targeting it at a group of people who might not disagree with his substantive concerns. He spends a lot of time in the beginning. He does this in the next chapter. I think we can sort of briefly go through the next chapter, unless you've got specific stuff in this.
Because
more of the same.
Yeah,
right?
it's more of all these other people are doing it wrong.
Everybody's doing it wrong.
Look at how wrong they are. They're really, really wrong.
Although what's interesting is in chapter three, I feel like he's a little more. He has a little more. There are notes of faint praise, but notes of praise for some of the theorists and some of the
scholars. Well, because he likes systems theory. Now, let's just take a step back, and this is one of those things where people who were alive at the time could give better accounts than we can. But Waltz is writing in for an audience that believes that systems theories are scientific theories. It's ironic because this book comes out after the peak of that kind of movement, right? I mean, that movement's, I think, kind of in decline by that point.
Mm-hmm.
But he's been working on this for a while, so maybe that's part of what's going on. But there is this belief, certainly in the 60s, I think, right, mm-hmm. that systems theories are scientific theories, that all science can be explained and discussed and analyzed in terms of systems theories. And there's even notions that systems approaches might replace analytic philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
This is the general systems theory argument that he kind of evokes a couple of times.
Right.
So there is he is working at least with the presumption that we are going to think that some basic level that systems theories are good theories and are the right thing to do. And part of what's going on in this section is he's kind of taking other people who have tried, you know, I've been along for this ride or doing this themselves, right? We need systems theories of international politics, and in his view, doing it wrong,
mm-hmm.
right?
And so he consistently criticizes a lot of different people who use notions of the international system for not actually being systemic enough,
mm-hmm.
and for committing what we, I think, could justly characterize as the primary sin for Waltz, which is importing unit-level attributes into their definition of the system. And because they keep doing that, he argues, they're not really talking about systems, they're mixing levels, they're combining things, they're not gaining enough abstraction that they can get some real analytical purchase on things. So he goes after Rosecrantz, he criticizes Hoffman, he criticizes Raymond Aron. The terminology is fascinating because whenever Waltz wants to damn with faint praise, he talks about the historical nuance that particular authors bring. And you can almost hear the mere historical nuance, even though he doesn't always say it.
Because he doesn't think that systems theory has anything to do with historical nuance.
No.
I mean, I think for me, the really important parts of this chapter, there's figure 3.1, which is on page 40. He just has this simple diagram where there's a box that says international structure. And under it, there's a box that says interacting units, and there's a line up from interacting units, and there's a line down from international structure. And for him, that's what a good systems theory looks mm-hmm. like. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to diagram other people's systems theory basically to show us they don't look anything like this.
Right.
You're right. One of the things he really hates reductionism. So anytime that unit level factors are driving systemic outcomes, he thinks you've got a bad theory. Mm-hmm. He also, and here I think he's on actually better ground criticizing a lot of these people. He also, because I, you know, to me, that's, I live in a post-Wallacean age. I think unit level factors can influence systemic or structural factors. And I think it's actually a mistake to treat them as if they can't. And it's not even clear to me that Waltz treats them as if they can't, but we'll bracket that for a second. Mm-hmm. He does make, I think, a fairly compelling case, if this is your cup of tea, that systems theories really have to have accounts of structure shaping outcomes. Mm. Of structure as having some sort of relative autonomy or analytical autonomy from units.
Right.
And I think he's right that some of these theories he's looking at really don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They really don't have a theory of structural causation
right.
or structural constitution. And yeah, that's a fair cop, I think.
Mm-hmm. There's no independent causal weight placed on the structure of the system mm-hmm. in these accounts.
And you get a couple of things that happen at the end of the chapter. Mm-hmm. After he spends a lot of time beating up on Morton Kaplan,
yes.
for example, really beating up on Morton Kaplan.
But not as much time as Kaplan spends clapping back in the book that he writes, the short book that he writes, doing a point-by-point refutation.
Oh, I've never read this book.
Yeah, I forget the formal title of it, but the subtitle is how to mistake theory and confuse a discipline.
Okay, sounds awesome. Okay, so he says on the bottom of page 57 that one should follow a systems approach only if it seems that system-level causes operate. This is the point I'm making earlier.
Mm-hmm.
One must then carefully keep the attributes and interactions of the system's units out of the definition of its structure. This is not a radical argument, mm-hmm, right? There's mm-hmm. a long tradition in certain kinds of systems theories of saying exactly the same thing. You've got to keep them separated.
Right.
That was not supposed to be a horrible 90s reference. But okay. And then he makes another really important point for his argument. He says, this is on sort of the bottom part of 58, a system's causes don't predominate, that they don't overdetermine things, that a system structure acts as a constraint on the system's units. It disposes them to behave in a certain ways and not in others, and because it does so, the system is maintained. If systemic forces are insufficient for these tasks, then the system either dissolves or is transformed. So this is, I mean, obviously, again, it's kind of like he's building to the arguments, he's building very methodically to how he's going to design his systems theory here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, basically, I mean, to cut to the chase, what he's saying here is that what he describes as system structure, which will be the anarchical structure, is
right.
the distribution of power,
mm-hmm.
that these things constrain and they affect the behavior of states, but they do not overdetermine them. States can behave in ways that are inconsistent with their structural right. dispositions. There are lots of ways they can cash out those structural pressures. And I think you and I agree, and Stacey Goddard, who I've done work on this with, and Simon and Chris
mm-hmm.
We all kind of, you know, there's a sort of been a wave of Waltz of scholarship that's really tried to recapture that. And so
mm-hmm. we waver.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. I mean, this is, so there are no serious agreements here. And I mean, I remember showing Ken a paper I wrote this effect, and he sort of, I just don't understand why people are confused by this. Right, there's a long-standing view. Well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
The last thing he says is the very end of the chapter is actually extremely mm-hmm. important.
Yeah.
He's talking about these other people who are getting it wrong. He says, in their sense, a system is a full-blown organization hierarchically arranged with differentiated parts performing specified functions.
Mm-hmm.
The attempt to follow the general systems model, and that's what we've referred to, has been a misfortune, for our subject matter does not fit the model closely enough to make the model useful. International politics lack the articulated order and the hierarchical arrangements that would make a general systems approach appropriate. I think this is an important point, and you know I think this is an important point. Not that I agree with it, but it's a really important line of argument, which he will then develop later, which is essentially that the people who are doing systems theory in IR are appropriating ideas from social and anthropological and other types of systems theory that were designed to describe domestic societies, or they were designed to describe particular organizations, right?
Right.
And those then presuppose divisions of labor functional differentiation, and often highly articulated disease has functional differentiation, and the international system just looks different. And so there's a kind of error at the outset in all these systems theories that means they're all going to be wrong, which is that they don't notice that there's something different about international politics. This is one of the reasons I think Waltz becomes so kind of cited and invoked and so central, is that he's also simultaneously giving us an argument for why international politics is a distinct field of study, mm-hmm. Versus domestic politics, you know, comparative politics, etc. And that argument, I think, even beyond Waltz, has a lot of staying power, yes. Right? Because we have to justify why we're, I mean, we don't really, but,
but we feel compelled to, and then this often becomes one that we...
So then chapter four is reductionist and systemic theories, and so now he's going to tell us more about... He's going to be critiquing more people, too.
Yes. Oh, yes.
but he's going to be telling us about how system theories can't be... More about why they can't be reductionist and what it means for them not to be reductionist. Do you have thoughts about this chapter?
Well, the thing that jumps out to me is... It's not until page 69 that we get a really clear definition of what he means by explain, right? We learn from the very first chapter that theories explain laws. Mm-hmm. But when he is talking about the difference between reduction and systemic theory, this is when he really goes into this question of what it means to explain things, right? What do I mean by explain, he says. I mean explain in these senses. To say why the range of expected outcomes falls within certain limits, to say why patterns of behavior recur, to say why events repeat themselves, including events that none or few of the actors may like. So there's a lot lumped in there. Mm-hmm. But I think what's really fascinating is, for Waltz, an explanation always has to be tied to some notion of generality. So even though, and we've commented on this already, and I think when we get to the empirical part, we'll comment on this even more, even though in practice what Waltz does is singular causal explanation, at the level of methodological or philosophical conceptualization, he's not thinking about this in terms of single causes. He's thinking about this as general causes, mm-hmm. because explanations for him are always about patterns that recur again and again over time. So the structure of the system produces recurrence. Mm-hmm. It doesn't produce individual events, which is fascinating. Because this then allows Waltz, because this is about systemic and reductionist, to further differentiate and say the only thing you can do at the unit level is describe particularities or explain particularities, but the system is sort of by definition always about explaining generalities.
So there are a couple of things that strike me as interesting here. There's actually a lot of stuff. There's something about the style of this chapter that's interesting, right? I mean, mm-hmm. he talks about the apocryphal book of First Maccabees, and yes. it's like World War I, right? You know, it's mm-hmm. a little, you know, whatever. But so there are a couple of things that stick out to me. This is the chapter where he starts to really kind of merge systemic thinking as he understands it with realism, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. so these things start to come together, right? So right. on 66, just after that thing about the Maccabees, he says, "The texture of international politics remains highly constant. Patterns recur, yeah. and events repeat themselves endlessly. The relations that prevail internationally seldom shift rapidly in type or in quality. They are marked instead by dismaying persistence, a persistence that one must expect so long as none of the competing units is able to convert the anarchic international realm into a hierarchic one."
Right.
Right? And it's this move where he says basically the fact that international politics always looks the same, which is a realist argument, mm-hmm. that international politics always looks the same, and what always looks the same means... He actually spends a lot of ink on at various yeah. points, and this is highly contentious. But that's kind of where we get into realism, because what politics means is sort of the pursuit of power and security. And it's no accident that, you know, he's just talked about how lack of peace in the Middle East and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. The second thing that strikes me is that, he really hates behaviorism. He makes an argument here that he shows up again and again, but this is the first time it really struck me. Where he starts arguing that he basically starts accusing statistical analysis as being like Ptolemaic epicycles.
Yeah.
So this idea that you get variation based on your model, and so you stick on another variable to explain the additional variation, and you stick on another variable to explain the additional variation. Now, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that's quite right. But what's interesting is that for him, he's doing Copernicanism
right.
in the Kuhnian sense. He's doing revolutionary science, and these people are doing epicycles. Mm-hmm. They're just adding on stuff to explain less and less, and we got to go with Ken Wallace's argument, if we're ever going to be a proper science. And that's interesting, like in an era when we actually tend to associate science with you know, data science and large N analysis, right? To have this very different conception of what makes something scientific.
And it's very similar in interesting ways to the critique that Heywood Alker made of the Correlates of War project a few years earlier than this, back in 1964, where he had said, you cannot reach theory simply by aggregating variables, no matter how fine-grained your correlations are, because you may need different math to be able to model some of these things. So it's an interesting parallel to sort of think about Alker's criticism of this and Waltz's criticism of this actually being kind of along the same lines.
Mm-hmm. I mean, again, he then talks a bunch more about like the basic point about systems and structure. You know, so on page 70, a theory of international politics can succeed only if political structures are defined in ways that identify their causal effects and show how these effects vary as structures change. From anarchy, one infers broad expectations about the quality of international political life. Distinguishing between anarchic structures of different types permits somewhat narrower and more precise definitions of expected outcomes. That distinction is going to wind up being the distribution of power.
Right.
Now, in fact, it is within a paragraph or two. Now, this is there's actually something that happens on page 71 that I really found interesting. I tweeted about it. I knew this sort of stuff was there because I've, you know, read the book before, but I thought this was particularly striking. So there's an argument when the isms were a thing and we spent our time arguing about isms in either the good old days or the retrograde old days, depending on how you look at it, oftentimes people would say structuralism says there can be no cooperation, the EU happened, there ergo structural realism is flawed. And on page 71, Waltz says, because, you know, and I always thought this was interesting because it's not like realists don't know about the European Union. So he's writing before the European Union, but he says, he's talking about how it's the possibility of war that makes concern for relative power so important, right? And when you're concerned about war, you worry a lot about relative gains and relative advantages. So even if cooperation might lift everybody's boats, even if you might all be better off, what you as a leader of a state are worried most about is not whether you're going to be better off, but whether the other guy's going to be better off than you out of it. So whether or not you can maintain your relative position in international politics. And that's because of the omnipresent threat of war, and the omnipresent threat of war is because of anarchy. So he says, once the possibility of war among states disappears, all of them can more freely run the risk of suffering a relative loss. Enterprises more beneficial to some parties than others can be engaged in, partly in the hope for the latter that other activities will reverse the balance of benefits, and partly in the belief that overall the enterprise itself is valuable. Mm-hmm. And his example of this is hard bargaining with the European Economic Community. And he says, look, it is the case that they still care about relative gains, but they don't care as much. And the reason they don't care as much is that the U.S. has solved their security dilemma. The U.S. essentially hegemony, he says, is a function of bipolarity, which is going to matter a lot later because when he actually makes arguments that support hegemonic stability theory, and he really doesn't want to, hegemonic stability theory is the theory that stable systems have one dominant actor and that international politics is a story not about the dynamic equilibriums that keep on coming back to balances of power, but a result of cycles in which the sort of stable equilibrium is one dominant power that is ordering the rest of international politics. Nonetheless, he says that basically NATO, the United States running some of the defense affairs and making sure Germany and France don't fight one another, has removed enough of this concern about relative gains that you can get fairly intense cooperation. And then he says about that is, this example helps to show us what a theory of international politics can and cannot tell us. It can describe the range of likely outcomes of the actions and interactions of states within a given system and show how the range of expectations varies as systems change. It can tell us what pressures are exerted and what possibilities are posed by systems of different structure. But it cannot tell us just how and how effectively the units of a system will respond to those pressures and possibilities.
Yeah.
Right. Then he has some arguments about change across systems. He says system theories explains change across systems, but not change within them.
Mm-hmm. Because you have different structural principles sort of...
Right, changes within them is sort of the patterns of interaction that do not rise to structure.
But can I pause on that for just a second? Yeah. Because there's something really important methodologically, I think, here. Because when... One of the things that was clear to me in rereading this book is Waltz mixes... sort of scholarly voices, if you will. Sometimes he's talking about the system, which is to say he's talking about the theoretical construct that he has produced. And sometimes he's talking about international affairs. And he's not always clear about which one he's talking about at which point in time, because if it is true that a systems theory, structurally we can describe and understand the pressure states are subject to, but we cannot predict how they will react to pressures without knowledge of their internal dispositions, then logically he couldn't ever say the structure of the system inclines states to do this. He could say the structure of the system suggests that states should do this, but whether states do it or not, it's the ambiguity of the word inclined.
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem, right? This is a fundamental issue of the theory, and we're an hour in, and we're, you know, not even halfway through the book. Ironically, we didn't mean this, but this is a mirror image of the better podcast we've modeled ourselves after, because they always go on forever, and they're always like, oh my God, we're going on forever. But, you know, I understand why they do that. What was I saying?
But this
I was,
is a key ambiguity. Right. Here.
So there is a kind of argument within certain kinds of systems theory that says that there is this notion that you can have structural dispositions that are acting on a lot of actors, and while those structural dispositions will not necessarily, if you take any one of them, can't necessarily expect them to respond to those adequately for the structure to really explain their behavior in themselves. Mm-hmm. But sort of across the population, that structural inclinations will be sufficient to produce behavior that reinforces, you know, that sort of reproduces. How does that make sense? And he draws this famous analysis with microeconomics that we don't really know, have to know what's in the firms to know that these structural pressures over time will have the effects of
it. It's such a strange argument, though, because he's reading the effect of certain kinds of behavioral conformity, taking the effect of that, logically abstracting from it, turning that into a thing called the structure of the system, positing that it then has effects on the actors themselves who have been producing it. To me, this only makes sense if you read the structure of the system, and I just put air quotes around that, as an ideal type, as not something that actually physically exists, but as something logically pure.
Something that if we continue this podcast, you're going to quickly learn is that everything that is good in Patrick's world is an ideal type.
Weber.
I mean, we could go through this, but I think, you know, you basically have already gotten the argument. He's just elaborating it. The key additional quotation I read is on 78 towards the end, when he says, a system that is independent of initial conditions is said to display equifinality. That is, you get different pathways, different dynamics that all kind of result in the same end state. In this case, for him, that's going to be balancing equilibria. And if it does, quote, the system is then its own best explanation and the study of its present organization, the appropriate methodology, end quote. And then he says, you know, he takes another stab at reductionism, right? The reason we haven't seen this properly is that we're all too reductionist. We blur the distinction between systems and units.
Right.
So chapter 5, political structures. Did you have any kind of big reaction to that? Because there are two things that I want to talk about here.
There are two things that I want to talk about here.
Maybe they're the same things.
Well, let's see.
Okay.
The first thing that struck me is he writes an entire chapter called Political Structures and never defines political.
Yeah.
So there's really no... The closest in the whole book that I actually found of a definition of political doesn't come until the next chapter, so let me skip ahead real quick just to chip at page 113. He contrasts, he says, national politics is the realm of authority, administration, and law. International politics is the realm of power, struggle, and accommodation. The international realm is preeminently a political one. That's about as close as he gets to defining politics.
And it's weird because when his discussion of domestic systems, political structures and domestic systems, it really sounds like he's talking about governance arrangements,
yes,
as being structures.
And that was my second point that I noted in chapter 5, which is that you could take the word structure out of this and simply talk about it in terms of governmental procedures and institutions and processes, and you could have basically the same argument.
Right.
The argument he makes about party discipline in the British system is a pretty good argument, that the prime minister has a different kind of position because of their different relationship to their party. That makes sense to me if we try to compare what's going on in a presidential system and a parliamentary system. It makes sense to lots of people who compare presidential and parliamentary systems. But I don't know that we need the notion of the structure of the system in order to make that work. I think you could do that simply by talking about these different practices of governance and practices of authority relations and how those combine with each other. So I don't know what value we get additionally by referring to it as the structure of a system.
Well, that has to do with his argument, is it in this chapter? I get so confused. Right? Mm-hmm. I had all these detailed notes about what was in what, and it all blurs together.
Well, because he starts doing ordering principles at the end of this chapter,
right? But
the character of the units.
You know what I mean is that this our assistance, the structure is positional and relational,
right? As you know. Right. As we know well, since we've been writing about this for 20-odd years, you know, positional and relational, like, those could
they
be some
mean
of
different
our middle
things.
Names.
I mean, this is some of the really kind of big blind spots
absolutely.
In his argument.
Absolutely.
Or they're a sign more of the way that he's fusing different kinds of mm-hmm. arguments together. Mm-hmm. And that's fine, right? Innovation mm-hmm. comes from fusion. I mean, there's nothing more sure. boring than, and I'm guilty of this myself, than endless discussions of how that guy is or that gal is wrong because they misunderstood the theorist they're drawing upon, instead of like, well, okay, but let's just take their argument as it is and right. see whether that makes sense.
Yeah.
But, you know,
also
who am I to argue with that publication strategy?
Mm-hmm.
The thing that really struck me about this book that I did, this chapter, which I didn't remember, this is basically a second book.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is where I think the Simon Pratt's and Christopher LaRoche's, however you say your name, is sort of like this book is half of this book, you know, a third of this book is Man, the State, and War.
Mm-hmm.
A third of this book is his second book.
Yes.
And then a third of this book is sort of clarifying things about that,
right?
I mean, with some new analytic language.
Mm-hmm.
So we get a lot of discussion about the difference between prime ministerial systems in the United Kingdom and presidential systems in the United States.
Yep.
A lot.
Mm-hmm.
Some of which is kind of, you know, hilarious in retrospect about how the parliamentary system produces cool, steady leadership,
mm-hmm.
adequately socializes them, constrains them by their parties.
There are several parts now where I have newly marginally scribbled in the word Boris.
Right. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
As my daughter recently pointed out, that his first name is Alexander. Anybody who chooses to call himself Boris should be immediately suspect when you can choose Alexander. Sorry to all the Borises out there. So there is this really long discussion
yes.
of this stuff, right? So then he goes on to ordering principles. And this is where he's really hammering home the idea that there's a distinction between anarchic and hierarchic systems.
Right.
And that anarchic systems are, he spends a while talking about ordering principles before that. Interesting stuff that will launch a thousand constructivist criticisms. He talks about how in both types of systems, structures are formed by the coaction of their units in both economics and in international political systems, you know, et cetera. But he's really starting to develop this idea that there are these distinctions, right? So he makes arguments like, you know, look, in domestic systems, there is still self-help, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like things are all coming up roses in domestic politics, and you never have to protect yourself or you're never on your own, but there is a lot less self-help than there is in international politics, according to
right.
him, right? You know, there are police officers and courts you can go to. Now, those police officers and courts may just be in the service of the powerful, but they're still there. And
it's very, very Hobbes reminiscent.
Well, look, this. You could just skip this entire chapter,
mm-hmm.
right? And say, and maybe is it the next chapter too? I know you could skip this chapter, right? And basically say it's Hobbes, right? That what he's basically arguing here is that what makes anarchic orders distinctive is that the self-help principle, the fact that every unit is ultimately responsible for their own security and defense, means that they cannot specialize,
mm-hmm.
right? You cannot mm-hmm. get an articulated division of labor. And this is Hobbes' argument. This is why life is what poor, nasty, brutish, short.
Solitary, poor, yeah. nasty, brutish, and short.
Right. It's not that everybody's killing each other all the time. It's that you can't specialize in being an artist,
right?
So you don't get good art when everybody who could be an artist is also learning how to, you know, wield a spear,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Or trying to feed themselves. You need that division of labor in order to have, you know, you can't have lawyers, right? Unless somebody can go and specialize in being a lawyer, because they don't have to worry about growing food, or mm-hmm. they don't have to worry about defending themselves. And so Waltz's argument here is basically that. It's that in domestic politics, you get a well-articulated division of labor, which is why structural arguments about structural variation from domestic politics really don't help you,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, it was interesting for me to be reading this, because he's really doing this in the context of this comparison of what he calls political structures, government versus anarchy.
Right.
But what he doesn't say here that explicitly, and it comes up a couple of times in passing, but never as explicitly as I think it should have, because I think this would have helped us a lot with what happens with constructivism in the 90s and 2000s, mm-hmm. is he doesn't really explicitly say, look, if you don't have divisions of labor, you can't have role differentiation.
Right.
And the way that most sociologists, and at least the Parsonsian tradition, understand variation in structure is by how many roles there are and what the expectations of those roles are, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So you don't get all of this kind of social, sort of deep social textual variation that you get in Durkheim's organic solidarity world, or you get in really basically anything. Like, if I want to talk about the difference between American social structure in the 50s and the 90s, I'll talk about things like gender roles, mm-hmm. right? And I'll talk about things about notions of masculinity and race and things like that. That kind of variation, he thinks, just drops out mm-hmm. because there's that variation depends ultimately on functional differentiation. Which doesn't exist
right.
in international politics.
Mm-hmm.
You and I both agree that that's probably wrong. And in fact, there's Ruggie's famous critique, which we do not have time to talk about, is going to argue that functional differentiation is driving the whole damn thing
right.
because you can't have states as self-sufficient entities until you get functional differentiation
mm-hmm.
and you can't have sovereign territoriality until you get that. And that launches a whole genre of international change literature.
Right.
But this is kind of where he's at. And he really extensively uses this economics analogy. This reason we can do this in international politics, we can talk about units behaving this way in a competitive environment is this analogy to the study of firms in economics. And that analogy is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger
mm-hmm.
as the book goes on.
Yeah.
Right. Do you have any other thoughts about this chapter?
No. I mean, the other thing that...
I could not make any sense of his figures in this chapter, by the way.
Oh.
But I'm sorry. But...
Well, yeah, I mean, the strange circle on page 100 where all of a sudden you have this system which is sort of looking inward is very
anyway,
strange.
So I'm sorry, but you were saying...
Well, but particularly, it's and this is the theme that I've been harping on a little bit, but this question about the epistemic status or the reality of a structure, because he says at the very beginning of this or near the beginning of this chapter, he has this thing on page 80, structure is not something we see. He quotes an anthropologist saying we're in the realm of grammar and syntax. Structure is an abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, if structure is an abstraction, then logically those diagrams that he's drawing there have to be abstractions.
Mm-hmm.
But then he wants to claim that you can actually see traces of the actuality of those in empirical mm-hmm. examples, which is very, very strange.
Mm-hmm.
So when he's deriving, to go back to the presidential and parliamentary thing, I think it's something methodologically important about how he tries to do that. He says, I'm going to look at these two different systems and derive these two different systemic positional mappings, and then I'm going to say what the different expectations are. If that's what he's doing, okay, but the fact that he's been able to do that doesn't demonstrate that those things are accurate. By his own definition, then those things can't be photo representations. He's got to put them to work. He's got to do something with them.
Mm-hmm.
But most of what he's done in the book to this point is not do anything with this. So all of his empirical examples are just illustrations that are building up toward things. But he's ambiguous in his language, and it's almost... You can imagine a reader going through it and saying, oh, well, because he has these examples, he's just deriving this from the way international politics actually is.
Mm. So the important thing about this chapter is these bullets at the end, which are very clearly articulated. He says, structures are defined first according to the principle by which a system is ordered. So is it anarchical? Is it hierarchical?
Mm-hmm.
Structures are defined second by the specification of functions of differentiated units, which you don't get in anarchic system. The criterion of systems change derived from the second part of this definition drops out since the system is composed of like units because it's a Hobbesian world.
Mm-hmm.
And then structures are defined third by the distribution of capabilities across units, which he also says is true in governments, by the way, right?
Right?
Changes in this distribution are changes of system, whether the system be an anarchic or a hierarchic one. So the parliamentary system is primarily different from a presidential system based on the distribution of capabilities across units. And the same thing is true in international politics. And so what that means, kids, is that the kind of structural variation that matters to Waltz is the number of great powers.
Yeah.
It's whether we live in a multipolar system, he actually talks about tripolarity here. So, you just count the number of great powers, but largely in IR, we talk about, at a minimum, we talk about multipolar systems, in bipolar systems. Multipolars have, I've explained them, multiple great powers. Bipolar systems have two. We've now added unipolar systems, because Charles Krauthammer talked about the unipolar moment. And maybe it appeared earlier, but I don't think so. But unipolar systems have a single great power, and they are kind of like the hegemonic systems I talked about, although it gets thorny, and that's something we'll probably tackle in a later reading.
Yes.
And then we can have tripolar systems in which there are three great powers, right? And again, Waltz's big argument is that bipolarity is the best.
Mm-hmm.
But that is then, for him, that's structural variation. Everything else drops out. All the other stuff you would normally think about as being differences of in political and social life doesn't matter in international politics, does not affect the structure.
And that seemed like as good a place as any to end part one. I should have part two up maybe in a week. It depends on how much spare time I can get to edit the remaining recording. In the meanwhile, if you want to contact us, if you have some feedback, maybe some books you'd like us to tackle, or perhaps some questions about something we said in the episode, I can be reached at Twitter. My handle is @DHNexon. Patrick can also be reached at Twitter. His handle is @ProfPTJ. That's @ProfPTJ. And that's the end of this episode of Whiskey and IR. Don't forget, if you're old enough to drink whiskey, always drink good whiskey. See you next time.